Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
We have a great show for you tonight. The Reformation is personal and cultural transformation. So we get to some of the effects of the Reformation on society as an attempt to call evangelicals to wrestle with these doctrines, not only to recover the gospel, which is most important, but also to really make a stand for the Christian vision of life, which changes all areas of life. Later in the program, too, we're going to hear from Lutheran ethicist Charles Mansky from Christ College Irvine. Not so long ago, the great reformers, missionaries, awakeners, artists, musicians, workers, and visionaries were drawing upon their Reformation convictions as they brought excellence, creativity, compassion, and the gospel to their world. Today, anchors of network television lament the demise of the Protestant work ethic on the evening news. But that's not all. Our whole culture has changed. Our music, with very few praiseworthy exceptions, has become boring, unimaginative, happy music that's fun to dance to, but devoid of content. T.S. Eliot, the great poet and playwright who lived earlier this century, explained the state of affairs like this, quote, "A culture without convictions cannot produce great art." Eliot, a highly respected literary giant, pointed to the loss of a sense of Christian truth. Another writer celebrated in secular literary circles for her brilliant mystery novels and plays was Dorothy Sayers. Sayers wrote, quote, "It's not dogma that's boring, it's today's ministers who are boring, and they are so because they have abandoned the dramatic retelling of the story of redemption. But if Christian doctrine is irrelevant to life, what in heaven's name is? If Christians' ministers," Sayers continues, "really believe it is only an intellectual game for theologians and has no bearing on human life, it's no wonder that their congregations are ignorant, bored, and bewildered," end quote. You see, folks, the psalmist wrote, "My heart is stirred by a noble theme." But I wonder if we hear enough noble themes to get us stirred up enough to drag ourselves to church on Sunday morning, much less to stir us to creativity, excellence, commitment, and brilliance in the workplace on Monday. If you were to ask William Gladstone, the great Protestant Prime Minister of England, what led him on a crusade to abolish the slave trade, he'd tell you it was a study of Scripture, and particularly those themes which have been at the heart of the Reformation message. Or ask that great Calvinist David Livingstone, what drove him to Africa as a missionary, explorer, and defender of freedom? William Carey would give you the same answer. Or go back to the Great Awakening when its leader Jonathan Edwards revived the preaching of God's grace and God sent not only revival, but created the nation's greatest centers of learning and advanced the whole culture in so many marvelous ways. Go back to the Puritans. Wheaton College professor Leland Ryken calls these Reformation people worldly saints. They weren't dour, world-hating legalists who were simply waiting for the great escape from the late great planet Earth. They got involved in life, all of it, up to their eyeballs, and were salt and light in every field, in the arts, in political life. The majority of the English Parliament at the time were reformed, in the pursuit of human rights and liberties. Democracy itself is credited as a spin-off of the Reformation, and its fleshing out by the Puritans. Think of Milton, Donne, Herbert, and a host of other Puritan literary giants, or the Golden Age of Dutch art, with Reformed painters like Rembrandt, Vermeer, de Hooch, and so many others. Why were the French Academy of Art and the Royal Academy of Art in England both founded by Reformation Christians at a time when they were but a small minority of the population? Or look at the Reformation itself. Jews found safe harbor from the Inquisition in the great cities of the Reformation. So did the exiles who fled from persecution and instability of their homelands to find a greater, if not perfect, degree of freedom and liberty. Luther didn't just write about justification by faith, he drew up a plan for public education for Germany. Calvin did the same for Switzerland and France, and John Knox created the Scottish public school system. England followed the pattern, and this tradition was carried finally to New England with the Puritans. Folks, the reformers encouraged music and the dramatic arts by freeing Christians with these gifts from the tyranny of having to use them in what we would today call full-time Christian ministry. all of life became spiritual and meaningful because God was the creator, redeemer, and sanctifier of more than individual hearts. Johann Sebastian Bach, the great Lutheran composer, and George Friedrich Handel, who had been both Lutheran and Reformed, set out to put these great themes of the Reformation to music. In fact, the great composer of the last century, Felix Mendelssohn, who converted from Judaism, when asked why he composed a symphony in honor of the Reformation, responded, "In those days men had convictions. We moderns have opinions." We think of, first of all, many of the movements today which have tried to have a direct influence on the culture. For instance, the Moral Majority and other groups have tried to get Christians involved directly in the culture, and we criticize that involvement as running roughshod over the gospel and giving the opinion that by moral improvement, social moral improvement, we will save the nation instead of by the gospel. But how then can we say that the Reformation gave so many cultural benefits to society and in history when that wasn't its purpose? Its intention was to recover the gospel. So how come all these other benefits occurred?
Well, the thing, it's like love and marriage and Annie, Get Your Gun. You can't have one without the other. In the Reformation time, the theological was central. Roland Bainton has said, "You'll never understand the century until you understand that the major question in the 16th century was, how am I to be saved? Is Rome telling me how, or are the reformers?" That was the central question. They did not go at the thing directly. They had all kinds of cultural concerns, but they didn't go at it directly. They went at it, first of all, through a theological understanding of who Christ was and what his death did. Then the spillover was to culture.
What doctrines do we draw from, Rod, as Reformation Christians, which contribute to our interest in this world and its problems?
Well, I think both of our traditions, both Reformed and Lutheran here, would draw primarily on the doctrine of the Incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
The way our guys would say,
what is the Incarnation?
Well, that God once, when Quirinius was governor of Syria, became a baby or a zygote in the uterus of a Jewish girl.
Mm-hmm.
He took on human flesh. John 1:1.
Mm-hmm.
Our tradition, I think yours would agree too, ours says that all of human life is hallowed by the fact that God became man.
Mm.
So
he lived with us, he drank with us, he socialized with us, he went to work with us.
Yeah. Mm. So instead of seeing it the way the evangelical does, splitting it between my spiritual ministry and what I've got to do to pay the mortgage,
yeah.
instead of that, what you had was a view that Luther used to say, for instance, that the bootmaker now makes a good quality boot and sells it for a fair price, and that is his ministry.
The Yale historian Roland Bainton, in fact, writes, "The term vocation was transferred by Luther from the cloister, that is the monastery, to the workshop. This attitude readily carried over from the farm to the factory and provided the entrepreneur with productive wage earners." And that really is the beginning of the Protestant work ethic, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it's interesting that our culture decries the loss of the ability to do things with quality, but it never dawns on them to think about the theoretic underpinnings. What they think of is incentive plans,
right,
or computer
methods.
Computer-organized checking upon everybody, which is just Big Brother-ish. All sorts of bizarre sorts of things to recover this, but it never dawns on them that it was the ideology that did it.
We think, in terms of the Reformed side, which probably are the same from what we were talking about with the Lutheran tradition as well, of the motif of creation, fall, and redemption. If we keep those three doctrines in proper balance, we're okay. Creation gives us God's lordship over all of life. He didn't just create religion. He created all areas of life. He created work, and that was part of creation, not the fall. Work mm-hmm. didn't come out after the fall. It came as part of creation. The Imago Dei, that all men and women bear the image of God. That means even in the workplace.
Yep.
So there's not a difference between, well, I don't want to work with non-Christians. I don't like working with non-Christians. Well, they bear the image of God, and we work side by side with image bearers.
Yeah, and you're called to them as salt and light.
That's right. Responsibility for the environment. Creation gives us a certain concern for that. The fall, though, gives us realism. We don't hide from the realities of the fall. I think that this is why evangelicals, our view of sin is that it's external. So if we can just cover up nude statues and...
Does this mean I have to quit from my nude bathing club?
Yes, of course,
oh,
Rod. My goodness.
I thought it was of the order of creation.
And if you don't have, you know, any four-letter words in a book or a movie, it's okay. That makes it all right. But the Reformation presentation of life is with all of its warts. We don't hide from it. Sin isn't just the environment rubbing off on me. It's what's in my heart, and that needs to be exposed and realized. But then also redemption. There's an aspect, not only am I redeemed, but according to Romans 8, the whole creation is groaning with birth pangs, awaiting its redemption. So there's this holistic, biblical, holistic vision of life. And then I guess also eschatology. We don't believe that we're not premillennialists, so we don't believe that we do nothing until Christ comes. But we're also not postmillennialists, meaning that
Utopians.
We do everything until Christ comes. We believe that just as we can't be perfect individuals in this life, we can't have a perfect society in this life. Well, what about some of the other areas? Rod, how about music, first of all? What was Luther's view of music and its role?
Well, there are several that could be quoted from Luther. The most common one is that he said that music was God's second greatest gift to the earth, second only to his Son and the Word.
Wow. So
he had a very, very high view of music.
Was that Christian music?
Well, the rumors are true that he got many of his basic tunes from the culture. Mm-hmm. And his justification was, I don't see any reason the devil should have all the good tunes. he felt no reticence about borrowing from good hymnody. The one that I always remember, though, is as we stood in Leipzig at Bach's church at St. Thomas, and Dr. Montgomery was lecturing, and I had not known before that Bach, first of all, had as his life goal setting Luther's theology to music. Mm. But the second thing that I hadn't known was that his criticism at his home parish was that his music was too happy.
Amazing. Well, you know, he also carved into the organ there in Leipzig, Soli Deo Gloria, the Reformation's anthem, to God only be glory. And when God's glory is sought, not only in the arrangement of quote-unquote church music, but in the arrangement of quote-unquote secular music, where God is the Lord even over that sphere of our life, and that even that is for his glory, even though explicitly religious themes aren't involved.
Right.
Boy, that just, you could tell why the guy was a master.
Yeah, and look at the culture looking for this sort of theme. Why is it that you have business students required to read books in search of excellence?
Wow.
The culture is crying for it, but it has no historical connection with where this was done.
Charles Mansky is the ethicist, professor of ethics at Christ College Irvine, a Lutheran professor. And Charles, it's good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you. You're on a good subject tonight.
Yes, right on your home turf. Marvelous. I wanted to ask you, Charles, what specifically do you think accounts for the enormous contribution of Luther and Lutheranism from that side of the camp to culture?
Well, the Reformation opened up the whole society. In the older pre-Reformation period, you have the Roman Catholic Church saying that the church needs to dominate the culture.
Mm.
And in doing that, they excluded a great many options. And so with the coming of Martin Luther, you have, for example, Copernicus, who is a contemporary. And the Lutherans help him to publish his thesis against ecclesiastical supervision and what is really censorship.
In science. Marvelous.
Right. So you have, first of all, you have the academic dean at Wittenberg University, where Luther is, helping Copernicus write that thesis and getting it published with money from a Lutheran prince. And then you have a Lutheran professor writing the introduction to it. So in other words, you have from the very beginning, therefore, that freedom in terms of bringing Jesus Christ to the culture, in this case through science, and you've already mentioned music with Bach and Handel, you mentioned on the program already.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are marvelous ways in which the gospel is then brought out into the larger community.
Mm. How do the reformers then didn't see themselves as letting worldliness in through the back door?
Exactly. William Lazarus, who's a Lutheran theologian, put it this way. Luther proclaimed a liberating message that society need not be run by the church in order to be ruled by God.
Mm.
The later idea, which comes in as part of the Anabaptist movement, is that the world is very sinful and the times are waxing late, and therefore we need to separate ourselves. I've attended a lot of churches in Southern California as part of my work with evaluating 100 different religious bodies.
And so many
of these groups end up talking about the world being terrible and evil, that Satan is the new god of this world. You must separate yourself and work for God, who is somewhere in eternity, and we will eventually get our reward in heaven. I think the Reformation doctrine is entirely different from that. It says that God is in control of this world, that Satan is the great pretender.
Mm.
He is the great counterfeit. And unfortunately, we have some fellow Christians who have bought the argument of the counterfeiter, that he is an important god of this culture. It is God who made this culture, and it is good. And therefore, we need to work with it, whether it's literature, art, music, architecture, etc. And that's what the early Reformation people picked up and put in their art, depending on whether they were musicians, artists, historians, or whatever.
So they didn't just have to paint Christian, quote-unquote Christian art. They wouldn't even understand those kinds of terms, would they?
No, no. To paint only religious art, no. I mean, what they're saying is, if you have a build a building with integrity in it, that brings glory to God as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's from a rejection of culture, which H. Richard Niebuhr, in his book Christ and Culture, called the position of Christ against culture. The Reformation motif in Luther's case was Christ and culture and paradox, and in the Reformed theological case was Christ transforming culture. In both places, you have the use of culture for good things.
Charles, thank you so much for your wonderful comments. It helped us understand this period a lot better. Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet. Rod, let's move. We've talked a little bit about music. There's also painting. I remember I had a Roman Catholic friend who had left the Roman Catholic Church, and we were studying in Strasbourg at the time, and we took a drive to Paris to go to the Louvre, the famous art museum. And I took him. There happened to be a Dutch exhibition of Dutch Baroque art. That's from the 17th century, very highly influenced by the Reformation. And at first I said, let's go to the medieval section. We looked at some of the medieval paintings. He says, yeah, that's the kind of art I know. Then we went to the Dutch part, and I said, now, remember the nativity scenes back there in the medieval section, where the halo was over Jesus and the Madonna and so forth, and they all looked holy and everything and pristine. No crying he makes, that kind of a mentality. He says, yeah. I said, what do you notice different about this? And I was pointing to Rembrandt's nativity scene. He says, well, first of all, they look like a normal family.
Yes.
And Mary's going about her normal household duties, and Joseph is sitting there rocking Jesus. I said, where's the light coming from? Because in the medieval paintings, it was coming from the halos. He said, it's coming from the window.
Mm-hmm.
Natural light. You see, nature was not an enemy of grace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have come again to the place where we have an unnatural art. We have the pictures of Jesus look absolutely sappy and sentimental.
Did you grow up with Solomon's Head of
That's
Christ?
Right.
I did.
That's right. Yep.
The Norwegian Jesus.
That's right. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And realism, really, is not a part of it all. If we're building a building that's going to house a Christian organization, well, it doesn't have any direct evangelistic purposes, so it doesn't have to look beautiful and be attractive, a contribution to the community's overall landscape. But we have to print our brochures nicely, and we have to print our tracts well. We've really lost this sense that beauty for its own sake, because it glorifies God, is our aim.
Yeah, in our day, we get Christian greeting cards with the thing thrown out of focus and everything sappy. and in that day, you really had art which glorified the created world because it was the created world.
You think of literature. Reformation literature is realistic. It's not sappy or sentimental. It doesn't leave the tough bits out that we as Christians don't want to deal with. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress has a lot of realism in it, and it's still considered a classic. Edward's Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God is still read in secular public high schools. Think of education. Rod, what did Luther do for a public education?
Well, basically, he came into a situation where there was no public education. He started within the church to have fathers educating their children, which is interesting. Every genius that we've ever measured was schooled individually by his father, virtually everyone. Mill, Einstein, on and on and on. You find in almost every case, the father was the one who individually schooled the children at home. But anyway, he began what we would today call public education and did not see that as secular or as opposed to the gospel, but as an outgrowth of it.
Calvin took this, too, to Switzerland and France, and John Knox, who studied Geneva, took it to Scotland and wrote it right into the Scottish Constitution, that free public education for all would be the norm. And England picked this up, too, with the Puritans, and then they brought it to New England. So, folks, the public education system that we have was invented at the Reformation. The idea was arrived at by Luther and Calvin, and was pushed by successive generations of reformers.
Yeah, the medieval age didn't have anything like that. There were individual monastic schools, but that was about it.
Isn't it true that the rich people got education, and the poor people, the peasants and the farmers, just had to live with you know, their future generations being locked into this cycle of poverty? But it's the same thing that's happening in our cities today.
Yeah, and the criticism, I think, should not be primarily that the public school system in a democracy or a pluralism like America is not teaching the gospel. Just ask me about the time that a Mormon offers the opening prayer when my kids are in public school, whether I'm going to vote for prayer in public schools.
Exactly.
But I don't think that's the way the criticism should be. The criticism should be the lack of excellence.
That's right. That's where it is. When we say God isn't in the public schools, what we should be saying is excellence is not in the public schools.
Yeah.
God would want our children to have an excellent education.
And the other thing is that with what we're talking about, you can't cut the flower. You cut the flower and it looks good for a while. But what we're talking about is unless it's rooted down deep in biblical ideology, you can't have the results without the root.
Yep. I think two of the great institutions, Oxford, for instance, where I've been studying for the last 4 months and going back there Thursday, they have up at the clock at the old Bodleian Library, first of all, the reformers in a relief fresco as you walk into the opening of this old library, built by a reformed philanthropist, Bodley, Thomas Bodley. And they have up under the clock of this great old center of Oxford, Soli Deo Gloria, that Reformation thing that Bach had carved into the organ in Leipzig, and that I've seen in, carved into the top of pubs in Heidelberg, all of life loved a stamp.
Yes.
This Soli Deo Gloria, to God only be glory over all of life.
Now, the American, as you mentioned earlier, the American wants the result.
Without
he does not want the substructure.
That's right. Well, the fruit without the tree.
That's right. Give us the result and give it to us fast. Is there some pill you can add water to so we can produce this thing?
And Five steps.
Yeah, and I think if you talked with industry, you would find that there's a yearning for excellence. That is, can't we make a car where the door shuts?
How come the Protestant work ethic is dying or dead? Well, could anybody maybe wake up and think about, because Protestantism is dead?
Yes.
The tree.
Yes.
The tree is no longer drawing from the nourishment of its roots.
Yeah, or think in contemporary music. The contemporary contribution in music, at least from Christians, will be four chord mantras.
Huh? Yep, that's right.
And in architecture, Americans' contribution will not be the cathedral, it'll be the mall.
That's right. Unfortunately, it's true. I think of Geneva, what a great center it was in the social realm. Calvin founded hospitals. The deacons, he had a huge army of deacons in the church who were the social workers. They were the people, a huge influx of refugees from all over the world fleeing persecution and looking for a better life. And what did the church? It was the church. It was the deacons in the church who went out and got people jobs, who secured loans at the bank. The banking industry flourished now because poor people could get loans at low rates for the first time.
Yeah, that was revolutionary.
Absolutely revolutionary. And what is the banking capital of the world today? It showed that that kind of compassion for the poor ended up producing a better society. And it made people money in the process.
Yeah, virtually created a new class.
The middle class. This, by the way, it was picked up in Pittsburgh. A gentleman, a reformed person, tried to try this out in the burnout poor section of Pittsburgh. It's called Dwelling House Savings and Loan. His mission was to give poor people low rate loans. All the insurers laughed at him, but they said, "We'll give you a 6-month try." It's now doing so well that he has lots of investors, and around this bank in the rundown part of town, what was the rundown part of town, is revitalization. You see white picket fence going around old projects, and you wonder, where is this coming from? Well, somebody had a good idea, but it was inspired, again, by the theology that said, look, I'm responsible for my neighbor.
Yes, yes. Again, I think the key thing to the American culture is you cannot have the flower without the root.
That's right. I want to read a quote here from a member of parliament, the Dutch parliament. I met with him while I was in the Netherlands several weeks ago now. He's the head of one of the political parties there, and he had this to say about the way he integrates his faith with his work. One of the reasons I find Reformed theology so useful in my day-to-day activities is that it's holistic in the biblical sense. With Reformed theology, you don't run the risk as a Christian in politics of restricting the biblical message only to the sphere of the heart or to the church or the family. It provides a way of looking at society and the use of government, its limits, and its responsibilities for the weak in society. Also, I find myself calling upon my theology regularly in the realm of international diplomacy as we debate the shape of the European community. I worry, he says, when I hear about American Christians being only concerned with a narrow set of moral issues like abortion and pornography. These issues are very important, but they must be a part of a larger vision of life. The Calvinist tradition, he says, rooted in the biblical understanding of creation, the fall, and redemption, is neither pessimistic nor utopian about what we can accomplish. It provides a realistic vision. We look forward to the day when all of creation will be liberated from sin, knowing that it will only be finally and fully realized in God's planned community awaiting us. That is both my future hope and my present inspiration. God grant that that could be the hope and inspiration of many people who are aspiring to go into politics or into art or into music, that we may therein glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Tom in La Crescenta, good evening. What's your question?
Hello, I'm here. Okay, I was just listening to your program, and I just wanted to make a comment on your caller before, Chuck.
Yes.
Rather.
Yes.
He was saying that that Satan is not the god of this world. And I just wanted to make the comment that we got to be sure that we understand that the Bible does say that Satan is the god, small g, of this world, and he's deceiving people. Okay, and also in 2 Corinthians 4:4, it says that Satan masquerades as the angel of light.
Yeah, I don't think he's making an overall comment there. Probably the best here is a bibliographical answer. He made reference to H. Richard Niebuhr's book, Christ and Culture. That is a very straightforward book, and there's nothing like it. If you would like to do a study of how do Christians relate to the world, that is the definitive book, and it's not written just for theologians. It is a It is a straightforward, simple, wonderful work. And basically, he says, for 2,000 years, Christian believers have related to the world in one of five ways.
The god of this world, too, when the New Testament talks about Satan being the god of this world, it's in the context of the blinding of people's minds and hearts. But there you see that God is even in charge of that process. As Luther said, the devil is God's devil. And that the context is salvation. The context is redemption. When you say that Satan is the god of this world in the sense that he really runs business and economics and law and education and so forth, and therefore we ought not to be involved in Satan's employment, then you're no longer thinking as a Christian, you're thinking as a dualist, coming out of the Gnostic pagan dualism where you have a good god and a bad god. I'm afraid Charles is right, I believe. We have this kind of pagan dualism today where you have a good god and a bad god duking it out, and we're caught in the crossfire.
Yeah, isn't this a major theme in that Channel 40 stuff?
It is. It is. I mean, Satan is not running things. God is restraining Satan, and in that restraint, we have room to maneuver. And so we ought to be involved in this world. Does that help, Tom?
Yeah, I do believe that. And, you know, I believe in the absolute sovereignty of God and that God has to ordain everything that happens. On another thing is I was getting confused that you're talking about going back into the world, and I believe that we do have to interact with the world and preach the gospel, preach Jesus, you know, because I just came out of the world, you know, a while ago, and, you know, I was going to movies, and I was, you know, doing all the things that worldly people do, and that's how I got all messed up. And when I finally met Jesus, you know, he took me out of all that, and now he's sending me back to preach the gospel.
Sure. I don't think anybody would want to criticize that. I think the Reformation would want to say, after your conversion and as you grow in your strength and in the Word, that it might be that you'll even do something in addition to preaching the gospel. That is, that they were calling Christian believers also to build a car that worked.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the life of Christ. Before ever Christ presumably began talking about the gospel, he recognized that human beings in this world, and himself included as being one, had a big part of their life that overlapped whether they were Christians or non-Christians. Mm-hmm. And so the religious people of the day thought that he overlapped too much, that his life overlapped too much with theirs. They said, right, you must not really be the guy. If you were, you sure wouldn't be hanging out with these people doing what they do. You know, you must be a glutton and a drunkard like they are. And I think there's a real danger, Tom, in saying that God has taken you out of the world. Salvation doesn't save us from the world. Salvation saves us in the world.
Okay.
And so we're set apart to God, but we're not. That doesn't mean that we're taken out of this world and put in a monastery or in an evangelical ghetto.
Okay.
Does that help?
All right.
All right, Tom. Keep in touch. God
okay.
bless.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Kenny in Los Angeles, good evening.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, what's your question?
First, I'd just like to say I'm glad you guys are covering this kind of thing, because there's a balance that has to be reached that I think, when you talk about evangelical, it's a broad stroke, but I think
you
people
bet.
Begin to understand what you're talking about. I would like to ask a question about something you say every once in a while, and it just, you said it tonight also, so, you know, I know it's a little off the subject, but it might be appropriate, because you do mention it a lot, and that's about... You talk about people who believe in the rapture as if they're in la-la land and they have no understanding of the need for being in the world, and they're just waiting for the big escape clause, and you make sly comments about the late great planet Earth, which I personally have not read, but I understand the point of view of it. And I just wonder if that is a major part, not a major part, but is a part of the Reformation eschatology or not, because I'm not really familiar with the eschatology of Reformation theology.
Yeah, it's not the heart and soul of our gospel. I mean, there are people who read Hal Lindsey and like him, Late Great Planet Earth, for instance, and go along with the sort of the sensational end time stuff, who may not necessarily have problems with the gospel, on gospel issues. But the fact of the matter, as far as we're concerned, is the gospel comes to us and saves us in this world where we are. And it's not an escapism. It's dealing realistically with sin and realizing that we are still simultaneously justified and sinful. And so we can't look down our noses at everybody else. What we have to do is communicate with them and say, look, we're saved from the consequences of our sin and from the tyranny of our sin. But we like you are human beings.
Yeah. A bibliographic answer. One of the ones that has had a wonderful effect on people that I've known is picking up Luther's The Freedom of the Christian.
Mm, excellent.
I think Inspiration House probably has that mm-hmm. in stock. The Freedom of the Christian. It's very short. And there's Luther's view of how is the Christian to relate to the world and to his neighbor. And the other one that I think is worth mentioning here is Kim's work on Reformation eschatology.
Yeah, good stuff. I want to give one quote here before we go to our other calls. A Dutch art critic writes this of American Christians. For them, a quote-unquote Christian book is a book in which there is no swearing but preaching. Quote, Christian music is composition free from blemishes which infect opera and dance. A quote, Christian picture is a work of art in which everyone is decently dressed, preferably representing biblical figures. There are, he says, on the other hand, secular connoisseurs for whom art is exhausted in a purely formal game of colors and sounds, of lines and forms. When God proclaims his law from Sinai with thunder and lightning, these secularists have eyes only for the glow and depth of the landscape. Perhaps, he says, there are a few generous, humane Christians and a few reflective, reverent servants of art, Christians who have learned, through the manifestation of their Lord, to love the whole manifest world. Perhaps there are men on both sides who have not bent their knees to Baal, the Baal of a self-made Christianity or of a self-made art, but he who can kneel before God always and everywhere. Isn't that a great representation of what we're talking about,
sure
Ron?
Sure is. Sure is.
Absolutely. Mike in Echo Park, good evening.
Yes. Yes, my question is, I would just like to get you to comment on David Chilton and his book, paradise restored. I was a basic Armenian Christian, sort of hyper faith, sort of super spiritual, and doing church work. And I came upon this book and some people who were Calvinists, very strong Calvinists, and their testimony sort of changed my life in a positive way and got me more headed in the direction of being effective, more effective in society, not just in church, but actually doing something in the world to affect a change in the, for the positive direction for the manifestation of the kingdom of God. So David Chilton and his book had a lot to do with the Paradise Restored. And I would just like to get you to comment on him and on his book, if you would, please.
Well, thanks a lot. I think that first of all, he is a Reconstructionist. This is a movement claiming to have Reformed or Calvinistic roots, and it is associated in some ways with Reformed theology. But we think it's been taken in a more Anabaptist direction. That is, two halves of the Anabaptist movement during the Reformation. One half said, let's not get involved in the world at all. We think those are the Pietists or Fundamentalists. The other half of the Anabaptists said, we're going to set up God's kingdom, a physical, political kingdom here on earth.
With the sword if necessary.
With the sword if necessary. And I think that Reconstructionism doesn't fit that perfectly, but it moves in that direction. To the degree it does, it moves out of the reform direction. Thomas Goodwin, a Puritan, said this, having been set right with God forever by his grace already, we engage not in pious duties which serve us, but in those which serve our neighbor. The Christian, he says, ought to be more interested in serving his neighbor in this life than in serving himself for the next.
Nice.
Since we're not working for this, folks, since salvation is already secured, now we can do what we do, not to get God to like us, but in order simply to serve our neighbor. We see a neighbor in need, and we try to serve that need.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org.